just a string of, like, solo books, essentially? That's
a very good question.
Because, like,
it does seem that way.
Tobias book is a solo book.
Yeah. Well, it makes me wonder if this is the stretch before the end had been decided, so it's buying time a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
And I feel like, I don't remember when they decided to start, like, recruiting, but that must be soon. Like, before the Animorphs expand, and it's not just... I mean, it's not like anybody else gets a viewpoint book even after that, but
the
it's like the group becomes larger.
Yeah. Yeah, it did... I didn't remember this book, but that's no surprise. But it is definitely, like, Cassie's, like, Australian adventure and self-imposed, like, moral torture. Like...
She really does spend a lot of it beating herself up.
She really does, which...
Like in Cassie fashion, I guess, but even still, like, these things are not actually your fault.
Yeah. Yeah, it really did jump off the page, like, all of the crises of self-confidence she was having, which feel very particular to her and not as much to any of the other Animorphs, like, second-guessing themselves and kind of, like, self-flagellating a little bit of, like, the others wouldn't have done this. Like, Marco wouldn't have done this. Rachel wouldn't have done this. Jake wouldn't have done this. And I was like, they probably would have done something stupider, baby. Like, you, like, they may not have done the exact same thing.
Plenty of evidence.
Exactly.
They also make bonehead decisions.
Exactly. And it really, it does, I think, it struck me in particular in this book, I guess more so than others, since it didn't strike me as much before, but it really did strike me in this book that there is such a gap between how Cassie is portrayed by the others when other people are narrating and they're talking about Cassie's actions and Cassie's behavior and what Cassie says versus, like, what goes on in Cassie's brain about Cassie's behavior and Cassie's actions and what Cassie says. Like, I feel like the perception from the other Animorphs is often like, oh, like, Cassie's, like, the moral compass, and therefore, like, I guess maybe this is audience interpretation, like, what goes with that is, like, a very grounding force, like, a very sure-footed, like, sort of anchor on the group, whereas Cassie is not sure at all at any point in this book, and really struggles to feel like she's making the right choices. Which is the other side of the coin, I guess, of being the moral compass, that, like, that is what morals are, is making sure and focusing that you're making the right choices.
Yeah, because I think even when Marco is thinking about or talking about her, I feel like there's a fair consensus that even if they don't always agree with what her interpretation is or what her vote is, that they... respect that she is, you know, that she is, like, has a firm core of belief that is not swayed the way that, you know, you get the idea that Marco and Rachel in particular, but also Jake, are, like, pretty changeable and can, like, suit the situation and themselves as needed. And they don't see Cassie that way. They see her as pretty firm, which is a good thing to be, especially if you're in the middle of a war. But in this book, I mean, she doesn't see herself that way at all, certainly.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
And she doubts pretty much every decision she makes, which are all kind of made on the fly.
Yeah.
Literally, in some cases.
This is true.
A lot of cases, actually. There's a lot of flying and a lot of flight.
Yeah, and flies.
And also actual literal flies.
Yeah. I think, like... It made me, I mean, like, relatable, frankly, and I guess, like, that this may just be me saying that I'm most like Cassie in the group. I would be second-guessing myself every step of the way also. Like, I would also have a lot of moral qualms and feel very unsure and feel like other people, it was a lot easier for other people and, like, I would be the one struggling. I think that is relatable. Like, even if it's not necessarily your personality type, like, I think that that's relatable.
Plus, she's always very invested in, like, relationships, and she thinks about, you know, how her actions affect people, probably to a greater extent than Marco does.
Mm-hmm.
And so pretty much, you know, she can't get away from this belief that none of this would be happening to you know, to Yami and his family if she wasn't physically there.
Yeah.
But there are so many things out of her control that lead to her being there that, I mean, after a point, you can only make the decisions that will keep the most people alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she does.
Yeah.
She does get to be heroic, which is fun.
Absolutely. Yeah, she does delve a lot into, like, what ifs. Like, she does so many hypotheticals. Like, you know, if I had only, or if I had never, or if it just could have, or if they had, like, so many. She is very cognizant of her place in the world and the responsibility that she has, you know, for her actions and the consequences that her actions have on other people, completely unintended. Like, there's no way to know when she makes those choices what the fallout from those actions, from those choices would be, which is, there's no way to know that, but it's also, like, really stressful and then traumatizing when you're trying to make choices. Speaking as someone who's completely indecisive for many of those reasons, because my brain just goes, like, what are the consequences that I don't know about that are going to ripple out from whatever choice from whatever sandwich I pick at lunch today?
It's great to be a control freak.
Truly.
It doesn't suck at all.
No, not one iota. So I guess now that we've laid a little bit of the idea of the sort of general landscape of this book is sort of a Cassie book that delves into, you know, choices and consequences and also features her very much as a hero. I guess we should talk a little bit about what's going on in it. So this book is called The Unexpected, which I would say most of what happens in this book is unexpected.
Yeah.
As I was reading it, I was kind of on the edge of my seat because I didn't see the usual possible outs for the situations that they were in, which was, yeah, so good on K.A. and the ghostwriter for the plotting in this, because it took turns that I was not expecting.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, it's like it's a Western. And typically at the end of any Western, you know, there's a cornering sensation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're very much cornered in this book. And you're like, wait a sec. I didn't remember how it ended. Like, I didn't remember really much about it other than the fact that I'm pretty sure this is the source of me saying the phrase, no worries, which I have no business saying because I'm not Australian.
Mm.
Even though I think now it's sort of is something people say.
They don't own it. It's not like Vegemite. We're not appropriating, no worries.
I just would not have encountered it anywhere else as a kid, I think.
Mm.
You know, prior to the internet and people learning each other's slang, like, fairly organically.
Yeah, I did wonder about that. And it did make, because I say no worries like 50,000 times a day, and it did make me wonder, when did that start? And did it start here? Did it start later? Like, I mean, yeah, before I had contact with actual Australian humans in my life, like, I don't know. And did actual Australian humans in my life say no worries? And I have no idea. So if anyone has any clues to the true etymology and diaspora of the phrase no worries, please let us know.
Yeah, so anyway, the point is I didn't remember much about it other than Cassie goes to Australia, there she meets, you know, like, a kid her age, presumably she warps a kangaroo because she's in Australia,
it's on the cover.
No worries.
Yeah.
But I could not remember how it ended or what the twist was, you know, what the deus ex machina was.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time I got there, like, I did feel very much like it was, they had written a Western for Cassie, who is maybe the character least likely to encounter a Western.
Yeah.
Like, in terms of personality.
Yeah. I like that they gave her this, though. Like, I really did enjoy having Cassie as just, like, full hero, but still being Cassie. Like,
yeah, like, her major heroing, other than, you know, saving the family, is like, surgery.
Again. And I like how, because it's again, she did not bat an eye about any of that surgery. Like, as I was reading it, she's like, yeah, I'm going to cut off his leg. Obviously, she's not that casual. But as you're reading it, you're like, wait, what? Like, she's just going to perform an amputation? Like,
yeah, I completely forgot about that. And I forgot how she did it. Because after it becomes obvious that she's going to have to amputate Yami's grandfather's leg, I was like, oh, and but thankfully, like, there's a piece of bug fire there, and it's really sharp. It's already been established that it's really sharp. She'll just disinfect it, and that's what she'll use. No.
Surprise.
Right. She morphs a fork Bajir. Like, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, that, I feel like, is kind of a Marco move, because it's, like, really dramatic.
Yeah.
But she is right that she needs, like, the actual muscle force to do that. You don't just need a sharp object. Like, you have to actually be able to physically do that.
Yeah. Well, and the, I mean, she's amputating at the thigh. That is a meaty part of the body. And the bone, and, like, the femur is the biggest bone. Yeah, in the body. Like, yeah, you need some muscle to get behind that. So, yeah, so, record scratch. You're probably wondering how Cassie got here.
Literally, physically, emotionally, how did Cassie get here?
Yeah, how did Cassie wind up amputating a stranger's leg in the middle of, like, the Uluru National Park area in Northern Territory, Australia, which, I might add, I don't, like, so, I mean, I'm no expert on Australia, but my knowledge of Australia and its geography is decent for an American, so that's several asterisks, but unfortunately count for something, because the American standard is quite poor. However, so I don't, but I, if she's flying direct from LAX to Sydney, homegirl would not be flying over Uluru. Just gonna say. Because Sydney's on the eastern coast, Uluru's in the Northern Territory, it's more in the center. All the red stuff and all the bush outback stuff is more in the center. Geographically speaking, I don't see how it makes sense. But maybe, I don't know. But maybe something happened with the flight. This is pre-9/11 flight hijinks. Like,
I wonder how this fits into the Lost universe.
My brain.
We know there's a weird flight path in that general area.
Oh, my brain.
Magnetic resonance.
Oh, no. Oh, so many options. Okay, I have to shelve that, because my brain just took a hard turn, much like a flight going from Sydney to get to Uluru.
Well, I didn't ping that, because I am one of the Americans who's not familiar with Australia, but I was pleased that they only used Uluru.
Yeah.
At any point. It's like, thank you.
Yeah. No, that made me happy.
Probably because Cassie doesn't encounter any white people, does she?
My God, there's, like, hardly any white people in this book.
There are, like, maybe no white people other than, like, the bald guy, perhaps, and some of the human controllers at the beginning, the Marines, presumably.
Nice. Yeah, also unexpected.
Well, she's not on American soil. She's not with white Australians. She's with Indigenous Aboriginal Australians.
Yeah.
Which is cool for a kid's book at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's one of those things that as I was reading it, I was like, well, like, you know, could it have been expanded? Could it have been more nuanced or, you know, delineated? Like, any, like, it probably could have been more, sure. But, like, for what it is for the time, like, and even for now, I'm like, no, this, like, is, this, like, does a good job doing, like, what it set out to do in a way that were, like, Cassie was aware, like, they mention, there are things that as an adult I pick up on that as a kid I probably wouldn't have, where they mention the tourists, you know, the idea that, like, the Uluru is a sacred site for the, like, local Aboriginal people, but it's also a tourist site, and assholes like climate and stuff like that, and they don't really care about the natives. They're there to take Instagram pictures in today's day and age. So stuff like that, I think, probably I maybe brought a little bit more to the table and read in between the lines a little bit, but I think it still is hinted at reasonably well. So yeah, so Cassie. So the Marines, the bald guy, the controllers, flights, Australia, kangaroos, amputation. It all started. In the beginning of this book, Cassie is also very alone in the beginning. Like, it's almost like they chose a microcosm of the whole book to be in the early adventure thing that they always do at the beginning, where they start in the middle of the action, which they don't even start with the book saying, "My name is Cassie," which made me wonder, am I just paying attention now? I'm probably just paying attention now. It's probably been done before where they don't start with "My name is blank," but it did. I did notice that "My name is Cassie" comes on, like, page 2. So Cassie is, like, kind of on her own. Like, she keeps calling out for the other animorphs, and, like, they're nowhere to be found. She's in a seagull morph at an airport. I had kind of assumed this was, like, a municipal airport, but the more I read on, the more I was like, I think this is meant to be kind of like an international airport, which seems bananas to me, everything that was going down at this, like, international airport, because they had received word that the United States government had found a piece of wreckage from a bug fighter in the ocean, and were going to be transferring it to NASA. They were going to be transferring it, taking it off one plane or loading it on a plane to take it to NASA. And the Yerkes obviously did not want this because they want a covert operation, and if the U.S. government found out, they could potentially help. So the Animorphs do want this. So they showed up at the airport to thwart the Yerkes from intercepting this like bug fighter wreckage on the way to NASA. It does not go well. and so Cassie's like the lookout as a seagull. The Animorphs, I don't know where all the other Animorphs are and like why, but it does lend itself to the extremely humorous arrival of the Animorphs finally, where Marco as a gorilla is piloting one of the like luggage cart trucks. And in the two like bins in the back are all of the other Animorphs in their animal morphs. So basically a gorilla drives up luggage carriers and out pops like a tiger and a cheetah and a grizzly bear. Like, truly a wonderful visual image.
This is really a vintage book in a lot of ways. As you said, pre-9/11. The idea that any of this could happen at an airport.
Mm-hmm.
And also that NASA would be the government's first stop.
That is
if
true.
If they found what is extraterrestrial in origin. I don't think that would be the case these days.
Yeah. No, that is definitely true. So there are some Marines there that are representing, I guess, the military forces turning it over. And the controllers are trying to, I guess, convince them that they should take... I guess they're posing as NASA people, and they're trying to convince them that they should take the piece of wreckage. And the Marines are not buying it. And eventually it escalates, and people start shooting. The animals start attacking. Cassie is very concerned that one of the Marines is going to get shot. And so... and obviously... the fact that all of the animals have arrived has alerted the Yerkes to the fact that the Andalite bandits are there. So it's true chaos. And eventually the Animorphs are like, we gotta bounce. Like this is, we have to abort the mission because we can't actually do what we intended to do. Cassie, because she like cares about things beyond the scope of the main priority of the mission and is not willing to just focus on that and cut everything else away like most of the others, she is concerned that the Marine is going to get shot, one of the Marines, the corporal. And so she, as a, like, half run over, like, she's, like, not in good shape at this point, like, as a seagull. Like, she's not well, but she, like, hurdles her little seagull body at a gun so that the Marine won't be shot, and gets knocked out. And then... when she comes to, she knows she needs to morph, but because she's Cassie with her freakish morphing powers, she morphs, like, enough of a human to be able to get up and run, but not enough of a human where she's indistinguishable from, like, just a seagull, like, trying to get out of morph. So she's, like, some sort of, like, weird half-bird creature hobbling along, and she also pilots a vehicle.
This is so hard to envision, like, how on earth, like, okay, even if we didn't have streaming media yet, like, there are still cameras everywhere. It's an airport.
I was just imagining how hard it would be to envision this, like, if you made it into a movie. Like, how could you make this without laughing at that? Like, it's a serious situation, but, like, a half, like, seagull, half human.
A very large seagull.
Essentially, yeah. Essentially, like,
it has enough of an opposable digit in order to turn a steering wheel.
Yeah. And, like, Cassie's internal monologue where she's trying to drive is, like, hilarious. Because they all were making fun of Marco for not driving well. But then Cassie also is, like, struggling. And she basically ends up in a cargo hold on a plane. Actually, no, she goes into a plane to demorph. And they follow her in there. She locks herself in the bathroom, morphs a fly. They shoot a bunch of holes in the door. They put in bug spray, which I found slightly unbelievable. They were just carrying in bug spray with them, but okay.
Well, I guess by this point they... I mean, they're definitely aware that, like, one of them is literally like, she's, you know, if you don't, there's no point actually shooting up this door because it's probably more something really small.
That's true.
And
that
so,
was an impressively smart.
I actually don't find the bug spray too hard to believe because they, by now they must have encountered earth insects and how many there are.
They probably hate them so much. Just reminds me of Lilo and Stitch with the alien that, like, is enamored by mosquitoes. So she does get sprayed with bug spray, and she manages to make it down into the cargo hold of the plane. And then the plane takes off. And she comes to and is freezing in the cargo hold of an airplane, you know, over the Pacific Ocean, presumably by this point. It's not enough for her to just be like, ho-hum, I don't know where I'm going. Despite the fact that SYD is a fairly illuminating set of three letters to, like, really inform, like, come on now, Cassie. I felt like they tried to withhold the, like, mystery of where she was going, and I was like, why, this isn't necessary. As a reader, we know. We think Cassie maybe is not so good at geography for not knowing. Also, she's morphing into a kangaroo on the cover. Like, it doesn't...
Giveaway.
Yes, and it doesn't... It wasn't... with the reveal that it was Australia was not, like, earth-shattering to me, because you already know, and it's also like, okay, so she ends up in Australia. Like, yes, that's far. But it wasn't, like, Australia? Like, that's insane. I had no idea. So, yeah, I do appreciate the idea that Cassie was, like, rummaging through people's luggage to try and find, like, food and clothing.
Slim Fast bars, also a very 90s detail.
Yes, prune juice, Slim Fast bars. I was like, homegirl's gonna need a toilet. Like, this is not a, like, not a good plan. Why didn't she eat any of the oranges? Which also, you know, is not, like, a great, like, choice either, but at least it's some vitamin C, helps your immune system in this, like, very stressful time.
She was taking out a lot of fiber.
She really was. I was like, this doesn't seem like a practical plan, but I guess your sense of nutrition is not, like, great at, like, 12 or whatever. The bug fighter, the Yerks that were following her, are not giving up the chase. This was another thing that I was like, at first I thought maybe it's a municipal airport, maybe it's not a passenger plane, but it's like, oh no, it's an international airport, and it's a passenger plane. So the bug fighter, like, comes alongside the plane and, like, freezes it. They use, like, a freeze ray kind of thing. Because Cassie is sitting half behind, like, a crate, and her legs are sticking out, and then she can't move her legs, and she realizes that they've used, like, a stun gun kind of thing. Because she finds out later that they don't want to, they don't want to kill the Andalite, they want to capture it and get another Andalite controller. So she has to come up with, like, a plan on how to escape the situation. And I did enjoy how much, like, even with all of her self-doubt, I don't want to say that I enjoyed her self-doubt or her lack of confidence, but I found it relatable, and I enjoyed how much she, like, kind of heard the other Animorphs in her head, just because it made me go, like, aw, like, friends, like, where, like, she kind of heard Rachel telling her to, like, morph big and, like, not hide, so she morphs a polar bear, and manages to, like, fend off one round of attacks of, like, taxons and Hork-Bajir and things, and close the door again. And then she sets up kind of, like, an elaborate plan, which is pretty cool to read. There she, like, puts claw marks in the floor to make it seem like the polar bear also got sucked out. And she investigates, she, like, figures out a way to get up from the cargo hold up into the passenger area. And realizes that that could be her escape. And then she finds the prune juice, an old man's cardigan that smelled like mothballs, and a sleeping bag and Slim Fast bars, and, like, settles in for the rest of her, like, trans-Pacific flight. And then when they fight, then that's what she enacts. Like, so she goes up into the passenger area the next time they attack, and, I guess she morphed a fly to get up there, but then once she was up there, I don't remember specifically, but once she's up there, she's human, and she realizes that she can hide in plain sight, which still feels scary because it's controllers seeing her face, even if they don't know.
Yeah. I mean, and it seems like probably the best plan, because by this point, somehow they still are not expecting to find humans. Suspension of disbelief.
Sure.
But yeah, like, in the event that once it becomes clear what they're doing and how they're trying to, how they have, you know, they've assumed that, oh, if it's not where we thought it would be, then it is probably, it looks like a human now, and here's how we're going to figure that out. Like, yeah. The jig will absolutely be up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is where I almost goes off the rails, I think, because what they're doing it's not something you can, like, cover up necessarily, the way that the Yurks often choose to, you know, work covertly, and that's how, that's the hinge of their plan to take over the Earth, is that they're hiding in plain sight too. Nobody can tell. They're not being overtly violent. And in this case, in this little microcosm, they are being overtly violent.
It makes you wonder.
How do you explain, oh, you're landing in Sydney and you have a fucking burnt-ass arm?
Yeah. It really makes you wonder, like, what did they...
Never flying Delta again.
Exactly. Did Oceanic get a lawsuit after that? My God, this is just like a precursor to Lost. The smoke monster got on the plane, burned all their arms. Yeah, this part was definitely very stressful. So Cassie gets, like, clambers into a seat and gets, like, a blanket, because she's in a leotard still. She is wearing a cardigan, the old man's cardigan, and so she gets a blanket and covers up, like, her feet and stuff. And she has to be, because they're all the passengers are, like, stunned or whatever, have been, like, under the stun gun, stun ray. And so they start going around and, like, blasting people with, like, a low setting of Dracon beam to see if they'll react. So Cassie, there's no way that Cassie can get out of that. And of course, now I'm forgetting how she gets out of that. How does that?
She acquires a Horcruiser, I think.
Yes.
To, like, put it in a trance momentarily, and then, like, grabs a gun. Essentially, she's very John McClane in this book.
She really is. That's genius, because she's sitting on the aisle, and so the Horcruiser leans over her, which is what happens when you're in an aisle seat. The flight attendant leans over you to hand the, you know, Biscoff cookies to the guy at the window, and when
I hate flying,
it kind of, I'm usually the one at the window, so nobody leans over me, but as the Horcruiser's leaning over her, she gets her hand up and acquires the Horcruiser, and in that moment of, like, docility, grabs a gun and starts shooting. She thought it was gonna be set to, like, stun, but she basically, like, vaporizes a Horcruiser on sight. Which, of course, traumatizes her because she's Cassie and we love her, and that's sad. And she manages to, like, get her way off the plane, I guess. By that point, they've landed?
She essentially, like, hostage negotiates herself into midair. They haven't landed yet. She, like, jumps. They're, like, far enough down, like, out of atmosphere that she's like, you know what? We're just going to do this.
And this
she's
book, like, is bananas. You know,
gun to head, like, backing toward the hatch thing, the emergency exit that is on all planes. And, yeah, she just jumps out.
I love that Cassie is, like, an action hero in this, but also, like, an action hero that, like, interacts appropriately with Native peoples and, like...
is kind to dogs,
is, like, morally aware of, like, the implications of her, like, rash decisions and, like, high stress action movie style, like, situations. Like, God bless. I like this book.
Performs emergency surgery.
Truly.
I guess that is also kind of an action hero trope. But it's also a humanitarian trope.
Exactly. Like, we're blurring the lines here, and I appreciate that. But, like, she's a humanitarian action hero. An unwilling action hero that, like, is focused on the humanitarian elements of all of the encounters she finds herself in. As much as possible. I've forgotten. She just jumps right out of that plane. That is, yeah. She gets back down to the cargo hold and then jumps as a human. Mm-hmm. And then... the bug fighter goes after her as she's plummeting, and she's like, well, I guess I'll shoot it.
It's so cool, actually.
It really is. Like, I feel bad, like, calling this cool, because it feels, like, a little too, like, tropey or, like, disingenuous. I don't know.
It's essentially Air Force One, but with a little girl and aliens, which is way better than Air Force One. And I say that as somebody who loves Harrison Ford.
Yeah. No, this, like, top to bottom, it is, like, pretty cool. So she blows up the bug fighter, and then it's still plummeting to Earth. And she's like, well, guess I better morph something. So she morphs a bird. And then...
yeah, that's great, I think.
Yeah, and then she can fly. And then they're sending out a search party on the ground. So she morphs a flea... like, burrows into the sand in, like, the side of a cliff and then just waits. And they leave. And then when she comes out, she's stunned to notice that there is a human boy her age there with his dog that's like, so you were a bird. Now you're a flea, and now you're a girl again. Like, okay. Which they kind of coast by on, like, the fact that, like, the, like, spiritual beliefs of, like, the local Aboriginal people in the Uluru area are more want to accept, at the very least, if not outright believe, the idea that someone could be a shapeshifter and that there's more unity between the natural world and the animal world and humans, which is all very interesting and maybe something that could have been explored more, but, you know. I think when you put it in the greater context of what Animorphs is, like, humans being able to morph animals, like, I do think that's really interesting and through that lens. Yami takes her back to where he lives. Is it his dad or his grandfather that gives tours at Uluru? I can't remember.
I think it's his dad. His grandfather, like, carves the boomerangs and sells them, or has them sold, I think, to tourists as well.
Yeah.
Art galleries and stuff, but I think another member of his family is the tour guide.
Yeah. So Yami brings her back, and, like, they take her in, and she's basically like, I need to get back home. I am in Australia. Like, this is, like, a minor panic attack-inducing state right now, despite the fact that she just jumped out of a plane and shot a spaceship.
Yeah. I would probably be more concerned about the time zones and, like, who can I actually get a hold of and how do I get a hold of them?
Kind of. She was like, I'll find a way to reverse the charges. I was like, girl, how are you going to reverse the charges? Like, those charges are going to be nuts.
Long,
like,
distance.
There's
Remember
no
that?
Way. Yeah, exactly. But when she crashed, she knocked out the radio tower, and so there's no way to get a hold of anybody. She could ride back with the postman, but he arrived literally the day before and will not be back for another 6 days. Which, honestly, again, I'm the kind of boring person that's like, well, wait 6 days, and then I want to read a whole book about Cassie, like, assimilating and, like, learning the ways of the culture. Like, I'm that nerd that wants to read that. But obviously that's not exciting for a YA book, and especially one that has set itself up as an action book by this point. And the other thing, too, is she's like, the Yerkes will come back within 6 days. And me staying here, it makes, like, Yami's family vulnerable. And, like, I cannot do that because Cassie is, like, a morally upright person who feels bad about turning down, like, grub as, like, grubs, worms, mealworms, I don't even know, as a food source. Despite the fact she doesn't come from an entomophagous culture. I was reading about entomophagiousness. I was reading about bug eating over, like, literally last week, so I felt very vindicated reading this.
I remember reading about it when I was about the age that I was first reading this in, like, a National Geographic World magazine, and being pretty convinced by it. It's like, you make a lot of good points, National Geographic World. They do have a lot of protein.
Yeah, exactly. That's, like, I see all of the points. I don't know, having not been raised in an entomophagous culture, that I could. I feel like if they were transformed into some other kind of dish where I wouldn't be able to visibly say, well, like, this is a charred scorpion that I am very obviously putting in my mouth right now. I think, like, just the visual of it, like, I have a hard time, like, embracing. Because I'm not an adventurous eater to begin with. Like, this is not something that I'm naturally very good at. But anyways, we've gotten off on a large tangent about eating insects. How does it all blow up at the ranch, as it were? Does the grandfather get the cut first, and that escalates things?
Yeah, it sort of, I feel like it's almost simultaneous. It's like, you know, he's found this shard of bug fighter and been like, whoa, this is sharp as hell, let's use this as a carving tool for my boomerangs. And then he cuts himself because it is so sharp. And, like, the flying doctors are, you know, the only medical resource that they have, right? But they can't contact them because their radio is burnt out. And then pretty much immediately, I feel like after Cassie's like, all right, well, this leg's got to go because it is not getting any better. And it's only getting worse and it's going to kill you. So let's amputate. And then basically, like, the house is, you know, surrounded. Like, the shootout happens. And there's a big loudspeaker. And so why not? Mr. 3 is there.
Yeah, I was curious about, like,
always
what,
there.
Where did he show up? And this I like also...
They, like, come out with your hands up.
In 2 minutes.
Like, getting torched.
He gave her, like, 2 minutes. I really was like, that's a very generous time window to wait on, like, your...
She might not even be here. Like, she could be in the bathroom. We don't know.
Kind of.
She might be longer than 2 minutes. Yeah, so, I mean, being Cassie, like, her immediate thought is, like, okay, we'll just get them away from the house, right? They can go and kill me later, elsewhere. Just not here, where everyone else will die, too. So, then it's finally time for the kangaroo.
Yeah. Well, she had originally planned to morph the kangaroo that night and hop her way to the outstation, outpost.
Yeah, to get to, like, Alice Springs and...
Yeah.
Phone.
Yeah, and she would send... And when back when it didn't seem like Grandpa's wound was, like, so life-threatening, then she would alert the... What's it called? Doctor?
The flying doctors?
The flying doc, thank you. I was like, I know there's an adjective. I know the word doctor.
The dudes with the scalpels and the newsboard.
Exactly. So she would alert the doctors to go back and help Yami's grandfather. But then when it gets so bad, she's like, okay, no, we do need to take action. So yeah, so that's when she decides to amputate as the Horkbajir. I almost wondered, they don't say this, but I almost wondered if the fact that she morphed, like, alerted. But I guess they didn't ever really come up with that technology that's, like, the morph detector or, like...
Yeah, I don't remember how it's established that they figured out... I mean, I guess they just might have... There's probably not that many houses
I was about
there.
To say, there's a dwelling in the middle of nowhere. Let's try there.
Yeah, how far can an Andalite presumably reasonably travel in that type of environment? Considering that if she was an Andalite, I think it might actually be harder for her to travel.
Yeah, there's no grass.
I don't know. Anyway, yeah, so she goes kangaroo and leads them away, and then there's a... I guess it is kind of a cliche now how terrifying kangaroos are, but they really are.
This
reminded me of that adequately.
They really do, like, defy physics and also, like, are terrifying.
Oh, they're just jacked. They're, like, shredded.
Yeah.
Okay. We're both mammals, but, like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Well, Cassie had her kangaroo morph because she helped a kangaroo, like, that was stuck in some, like, fencing, I guess? Who had a little Joey in her pouch, and, like, she helped that kangaroo and then was able to morph her lately. So, or later on. And, yeah, like, the idea that Cassie is, like, mother goddess, like, earth goddess. And the fact, like, that she does do the surgery. Like, she's able to tell when infections are too bad. Like, she knows how to perform surgery on animals. Like, I really truly did love how much the earth, like, Cassie was, like, Gaia, but also James Bond in this book.
I liked, I mean, we were talking about her obsessive cataloging of her actions and their effects, but I thought that, like, I mean, obviously it was intentional because otherwise the author wouldn't have done it, but it's intentional, I felt like, in the way that, I mean, it, you know, reinforces her personality and how she is, especially when she's not being tempered by her friends necessarily, or, like, having to work inside that context and she's by herself. But also, like, everything... about this book, it was very butterfly effect in a way that the butterfly Cassie book also was, but in the way of, like, this is really the first, I mean, it reminds you that the scope is Earth. It's not just America or the United States. Because she's in a totally different country with different denizens of that country who are, you know, native, like real native to that spot in a way that the vast majority of people living in our country aren't. And so, you know, if someone's going to be, if you're thinking about Earth in at that scale and, like, who Earth belongs to, it's going to be, you know, Aboriginal people on whatever continent.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of her like, oh, if I hadn't made this decision, then this wouldn't have happened. This harmful thing wouldn't have happened. If I hadn't shot the bug fighter on my way back into orbit, I wouldn't have knocked out the radio, and it wouldn't have shattered into pieces and cut Yami's grandfather's leg and all this. And so it was very, like, cyclical and in a way that I thought was subtler and a little more elegant than some of the most recent books that we've read.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of tying the series' larger themes of, like, Earth's defense and who calls Earth home to the character, like, that's being depicted and her particular concerns.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, like, and Yami's grandfather kind of, I don't want to say he, like, wipes away her concerns or sort of, like, validates her concerns a little bit, but he does sort of, his parting words to her are a little bit, like, larger in scope about, like, the need to defend your territory and to defend your land from, like, invaders, which is prescient coming from an elder of an Aboriginal community in Australia. But that, like, it's incumbent on you to save, like, your, like, the sanctity of, oh, cause she's frustrated. She's mad, not mad. She's upset because as a kangaroo, she's going to be leading the Yerkes into their sacred river, which she also crash landed into, and then it like lends the like credence to the idea for the grandfather that she is a spiritual entity or more in touch with sacred like concepts and spirits and things like that. And she feels really guilty about that because she's just like an American girl that crash landed and was struggling to survive, and she doesn't feel like she's given that the respect and honor it deserves, which is why we stan a queen. But the grandfather kind of says, like, it's okay because, like, we have the larger picture in mind, like, the larger goal in mind, which is to protect what is ours that, you know, is not necessarily completely about this one ravine or this one river. It's more about, like, a larger protection of like what we are larger than that, than just one place. I don't know. I think that was slightly unsophisticated the way I summed that up, because I don't entirely remember what he said, but it was something like that, where it was sort of a blessing.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, from the get-go, Cassie's like tropes are like, you know, a little bit hippie-ish, earth mother, crunchy, you know, animal lover, tree hugger, all this. But this is probably the This is the standout book for her so far that is, like, an ecology book and what that word means and the idea of the fight against an alien invader as an ecology story.
I love her so much. It is.
In some cases of sci-fi, it's very overt, and some it's, you know, not so much, and there's other concerns, but who's exploiting which niche?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it never occurred to me until just now that, like, maybe when we get to the end of this series, it may make sense. It might be a fun exercise to do, like, a top 10. And, like,
yeah,
this...
It will be hard, but I would do it.
It would be really hard, but this book is making me go, like, maybe a top 10? Here we are in the 40s?
Yeah, possibly? It's weird, because you know, as we were saying, we didn't remember too much about it.
Mm-mm.
I remembered the very broad strokes of Cassie's in Australia, nobody's with her. She makes a friend, her new pen pal friend,
yeah.
And, you know, there's a kangaroo, obviously, but I didn't remember how she got there or anything about the finer points.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this is a good one-off, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's the best solo effort that we've had for a while. I guess we should talk about how, and we're at the corner, so everything has been cornered at this point. How does Cassie get out of the outback as she's a kangaroo? And it also was sad because she was with, like, a group of kangaroos, which is beneficial to her because the Yerkes don't know which kangaroo is the Andalite one, but bless her, she's really upset because they're killing other kangaroos, and she is actively trying to separate herself from the group so that they know which one is the Andalite. I love her so much. does she get knocked out? Basically, a chi comes to Chia Sex Machina out of this.
Yes, Lourdes, which is, if you have to have a machine of God, then it is a chi, and it is a chi named after a French saint, right?
Mm. Probably.
You know this.
Do I?
Or an area in France where something saintly happened. I don't know. Lourdes is like a, yeah.
Right. That sounds right to me.
Like, I don't know.
I'm not Catholic either. My brain keeps going Dolores Payne.
But you speak no. French.
Well, yeah, technically. Lourdes, the chi, just like comes. I'm like, how did she get there? Like, did she take a flight? Like, what power should the chi say? They don't have teleportation powers. Like, they gotta physically get their little dog bodies there. Dog robot bodies. Right?
I'm thinking about chi at the airport and, like, the x-ray machines and
stuff.
Oh,
no. Oh, that's
like,
true.
I'm sure they have it covered.
We can trust them. They got this. They know.
Earth technology is not going to penetrate chi hologram.
No, our technology is not that great. So basically, yeah, chi shows up and is like, I'm here to rescue you. Like, we out. And just like that, she's back home. And the next we see her, she's at the zoo. And Rachel is giving her a very hard time because apparently Cassie said, I want to go shopping. And Rachel got very excited. And really what that meant is I want to go to the zoo and buy a postcard. Not the zoo, the gardens. She wants to go to the gardens where she's like, her mom works and she's at like all the time.
And she could easily procure a postcard. She could have asked her mom to buy her a postcard.
She did not need it.
Which I thought was very cheesy and adorable.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is they all go with her. And Axe is eyebrows deep in a bucket of popcorn, and they all make fun
of Marco are very much dating in this ending, I will say.
It is 100%. That is fact, yes. That is inarguable.
Baby wipes?
Because the way they freak, because Cassie and Jake are like, because Rachel and Tobias are giving Jake a bunch of shit about being so upset and like wanting to track down Cassie no matter what, which like, fair. And they probably did too, but this is an opportunity to really make fun of him. And so Rachel and Tobias kind of do it a little bit as a couple, and then Jake and Cassie have like a little moment as a couple, and then Marco is getting wet wipes or baby wipes for Axe.
Like, I'll buy you another one. Like, he's the one buying Axe popcorn. Really, only because Axe doesn't have money, but like, they can give him money if he wants to really inhabit his human self.
Exactly. Nothing inhabits humanity like capitalism.
Right? If you really want to assimilate into American culture, you have to learn how to spend your cash.
Exactly. Buy wares for your coins.
Get yourself a little part-time job for 2 hours at a time. Get yourself some popcorn money.
A little shift work.
So that your boyfriend doesn't have to keep buying you popcorn and carrying on baby wipes for you.
Seriously. So Cassie buys two postcards. She buys one of a red kangaroo, presumably for herself, to remember the very unique once-in-a-lifetime experience she just had, and as well one of an osprey that she sends to Yami with just the message, no worries, on it. And that is how the book ended. One small quote to encapsulate the whole thing comes from Rachel, which makes me happy. In the last pages, they say, because Eric, of course, covered for Cassie while she was gone, and accidentally did a little too well on her algebra test, and now Cassie's mom is convinced she's, like, a little math wunderkind and needs to take, like, calculus next year, in, like, the ninth grade. Eric's a little too good at it. But Cassie says that her mom says, I haven't been living up to my potential. And then Rachel says, your mother can't even imagine how infinite your potential is. And that is so sweet. That made me so happy. It maybe was supposed to be just like a little offhand Rachel-style snarky comment, but also it brought little warm fuzzies to my heart, especially after like going on this journey with Cassie throughout the whole book, where like, she kicks ass in this book, and like, and she had so much self-doubt along the way, but, like, she did the best she could in all of her circumstances, and, like, it was good enough, and, like, she shined.
And she made a new friend. That, like, I thought that it was nice that she was somehow not quite busy enough saving the world that she didn't have time to worry about whether she was cheating on Jake.
Because of course she was worried about that.
Like, oh my god, you're in this house for 24 hours and someone's showing you how to throw a boomerang. That's it. It's okay.
Is this flirting?
That's a very Cassie move also. Like, not sure if this is flirting.
I mean, she said from the get-go that he reminded her of Jake, and they did have, like, a little capital M moment at one point. Where they, like, bump heads accidentally or something. Like, some real, like, meet-cute stuff, considering all of the other things that were going on in this book. So, yeah. It'd be cool, like, I want Yami to stick around. I want Yami to, like...
Yeah, why can't Yami join the Resistance?
Exactly. That would be amazing. He'd be so good. And his little pup. Who also, like, tore the throne out of a Horpajir at one point.
Yeah. I love everyone in this book, actually.
I do also. Because, like, Yami took somebody out with a boomerang.
Even if they could kill me.
Yeah. I'd like to think that they would sense your goodness like they did for Cassie. I don't know about kangaroos. It's like, ability to, like, sense goodness and evilness. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. I don't know if we have any Australians listening that can write in and give us the skinny on literally everything we've talked about, but know considerably less about.
The funny thing about, like, okay, so obviously the American stereotype of Australia is that, like, everything there will kill you. Mm. Like, Cassie could have just somehow hobbled the Urks in such a way as they couldn't leave, and that would have probably taken care of the invasion.
That's true.
Right? Like, you know, because all the insect life and everything in the ocean there.
Mm. Kangaroos. Some snakes. Some spiders. Snakes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's venomous. Yeah. And the sun.
Also that. The hole in the ozone layer is down there. That's not good.
I mean, you know, they straight up tell her that, like, you know, your human self cannot traverse the outback safely.
Yeah.
You can't do it. Your kangaroo self, maybe. But, like, you in your native state, no.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely not.
That would definitely be true for Horpajir who are outfitted for and from a forest environment.
Mm-hmm. Then when you were talking earlier about, like, the way that, like, invasion and, like, colonization affects, like, ecology, it made me think of the Horpajir. Because that was part, I feel like that was addressed a little bit in the Horpajir Chronicles, with, like, the forests. Although, I don't know if I'm making something up. I might be making something up. But the spirit of it feels like it's there.
Yeah, and I think that's always been present in the books as, like, a major theme and external in the fact that, yeah, in theory, they all could have acquired axe and become a little army of actual Andalite bandits if they didn't mind being clones or, like, you know, getting some cool tattoos in some cases or a weird haircut.
Exactly, just get a weird haircut case. Every time you
but
morph.
But instead, they, you know, they use animal morphs and they literally let Earth fight for itself.
Mm. Love it.
Which, climate change is so depressing, guys.
God. Well, that's the thing, too, is that even in this book, like, it is hard to read this nowadays with the, like, urgency of climate change sort of hanging over any conversation we have about the Earth. It's, and, you know, and climate change was happening when this book was written. It's not that old.
That's true. I learned about greenhouse gas from Highlights. When I was, you know, that age.
did Gallant really care about greenhouse gases and Goofus was like, puh, I'm a future Trump voter.
Don't vote for Trump, kids. Don't be like Goofus.
Exactly. That's I'd like to believe that Highlights would do that nowadays.
Highlights is still around and they still, like, whip ass.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. So did we cover everything about 44, the unexpected?
I think so. Although I will say, and I warned you that I was going to say this, when I was the MacGuffin here, the sort of inciting event of, oh, this piece of alien wreckage and the government has it and so forth. All it reminded me of was the news this week, which wasn't even news. It was like maybe second tier news. About Blink-182's frontman and releasing UFO leak footage and the government just casually being like, yeah, he shouldn't have done that because that's actually real.
How did I miss
again, this?
This
was like fully B-list news.
I don't... so many words you just said don't make sense to me.
Yeah, we are living in that time, huh?
Oh. Yep, it's 2019, and that's a headline. It's not a Mad Lib, it's a headline.
Yeah. So, yeah, anytime now that the kids have to either try to make a piece of alien wreckage go wide, in this case, or prevent it from happening, the Andalite toilet in Area 51, which all the Area 51 stuff absolutely reminded me of that. Like, we know it's an Area 51. It's an Andalite toilet. And, of course, no one on Twitter thought this was funny, but whatever.
Hilarious.
This is, like, this is the scale and the lens that I use for everything. It's just, how did this happen already in a book series from my youth?
Well, and chances are, if you're listening to the podcast, you feel similarly, because you are listening about Animorphs in the year 2019, and that obviously means that this book series had a lasting impact, as well it should have, because it's amazing, and it is relevant still, and it's sort of, you know, its themes are always pretty relevant, because it's like they were designed to kind of be that way.
I don't know, I like to think that Applegate, like, intended to make something timeless.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you encounter timeless material, you're like, yes, surely, the author was a genius. So, I mean, she's, you know, considering her own longevity and the mm-hmm. other books that she's made, you know, since, I think she's a pretty serious person, but I don't know that she could have really anticipated exactly how topical it would remain.
Mm. Yeah.
Cheers, Kay.
Truly.
Thanks for not being an asshole.
Truly. So speaking of assholes, 45 is next. Is that a good transition?
Yes. Flawless. Smooth as buttery grubs.
So number 45 in the Animorphs book series is The Revelation. Marco is morphing into a bug of some sort that I would not care to eat. An ant? Is it bad that I can't tell what bug? I think that's an ant. It looks like an ant.
Ants are never a good time.
No. And also, I feel like this might be Marco's mom related, so, that's also, I mean, that's a good time, but only, like, dramatically, storytellingly speaking. Emotionally, it's not, like, a super good time. It's emotional and traumatic. So we hope you join us for Animorphs number 45. What did I just say? The Revelation? and we hope you enjoyed Animorphs number 44, The Unexpected, as much as we did. Even if you're not, like, following along at our snail's pace going through this book series one by one, I think that even if you just picked this one up and read it as a standalone, it's still, it does stand alone, and it does stand out as a pretty good one-off book that doesn't necessarily plug into the larger narrative, but is still entertaining and also action-packed and also, like, thoughtful, because that's what Cassie brings us. So we hope you enjoyed, and we hope you're able to revisit it, and we will be back talking about Marco, ants, and his mom. Until then, have wonderful days.